Chapter 25. Isabel crept through the empty streets of Carrivaux dressed in black, her golden hair covered. It was after curfew. A meager moon occasionally cast light on the uneven cobblestones. More often, it was obscured by clouds. She listened for footsteps and lorry motors and froze when she heard either. At the end of town, she climbed over a rose-covered wall, heedless of the thorns, and dropped into a wet, black field of hay. She was halfway to the rendezvous point when three aeroplanes roared overhead, so low in the sky the trees shivered and the ground shook. Machine guns fired at one another, bursts of sound and light. The smaller aeroplane banked and swerved. She saw the insignia of America on the underside of its wing as it banked left and climbed. Moments later, she heard the whistling of a bomb, the inhuman, piercing wail. And then something exploded. The airfield. They were bombing it. The aeroplanes roared overhead again. There was another round of gunfire, and the American aeroplane was hit. Smoke roiled out. A screaming sound filled the night. The aeroplane plummeted toward the ground, twirled, its wings catching the moonlight, reflecting it. It crashed hard enough to rattle Isabel's bones and shake the ground beneath her feet. Steel hitting dirt, rivets popping from metal, roots being torn up. The broken aeroplane skidded through the forest, breaking trees as if they were matchsticks. The smell of smoke was overwhelming. And then, in a giant whoosh, the aeroplane burst into flames. In the sky, a parachute appeared, swinging back and forth, the man suspended beneath it looking as small as a comma. Isabel cut through the swath of burning trees. Smoke stung her eyes. Where was he? A glimpse of white caught her eye, and she ran toward it. The limp parachute lay across the scrubby ground, the airman attached to it. Isabel heard the sound of voices, they weren't far away, and the crunching of footsteps. She hoped to God it was her colleagues, coming for the meeting, but there was no way to know. The Nazis would be busy at the airfield, but not for long. She skidded to her knees, unhooked the airman's parachute, gathered it up, and ran with it as far as she dared, burying it as best she could beneath a pile of dead leaves. Then she ran back to the pilot and grabbed him by the wrists and dragged him deeper into the woods.
You'll have to stay quiet. Do you understand me? I'll come back, but you'll need to lie still and be quiet.
You betcha, he said, his voice barely a whisper.
Isabel covered him with leaves and branches, but when she stood back, she saw her footprints in the mud, each one oozing with black water now, and the rutted drag mark she'd made hauling him over here. Black smoke rolled past her, engulfed her. The fire was getting closer, burning brighter.
Merde, she muttered.
There were voices, people yelling. She tried to rub her hands clean, but the mud just smeared and smeared, marking her. Three shapes came out of the woods, moving toward her.
Isabel, a man said. Is that you?
A torchlight flicked on, revealing Henri and Didier and Gaetan.
You found the pilot?
Henri asked. Isabel nodded.
He's wounded.
Dogs barked in the distance. The Nazis were coming. Didier glanced behind them.
We haven't much time. We'll never make it to town, Henri said.
Isabel made a split-second decision.
I know somewhere close we can hide him.
This is not a good idea, Gaetan said.
Hurry,
Isabel said harshly. They were in the barn at Le Jardin now, with the door shut behind them. The airman lay slumped on the dirty floor, unconscious, his blood smearing across Didier's coat and gloves.
Push the car forward.
Henri and Didier pushed the Renault forward and then lifted the cellar door. It creaked in protest and fell forward and banged into the car's fender. Isabel lit an oil lamp
and held it in one hand as she felt her way down the wobbly ladder. Some of the provisions she'd left had been used. She lifted the lamp.
Bring him down.
The men exchanged a worried look.
I don't know about this, Henri said.
What choice do we have? Isabel snapped. Now bring him down.
Gaetan and Henri carried the unconscious airman down into the dark, dank cellar and laid him on the mattress, which made a rustling, whispery sound beneath his weight. Henri gave her a worried look. Then he climbed out of the cellar and stood above them.
Come on, Gaetan.
Gaetan looked at Isabel.
We'll have to move the car back into place. You won't be able to get out of here until we come for you. If something happened to us, no one would know you were here.
She could tell he wanted to touch her, and she ached for it. But they stood where they were, their arms at their sides.
The Nazis will be relentless in their search for this airman. If you're caught...
She tilted her chin, trying to hide how scared she was.
Don't let me be caught.
You think I don't want to keep you safe?
I know you do,
she said quietly. Before he could answer, Henri said,
Come on, Gaetan, from above.
We need to find a doctor and figure out how to get them out of here tomorrow.
Gaetan stepped back. The whole world seemed to lie in that small space between them.
When we come back, we'll knock 3 times and whistle, so don't shoot us. I'll try not to, she said.
He paused.
Isabel.
She waited. But he had no more to say, just her name, spoken with the kind of regret that had become common. With a sigh, he turned and climbed up the ladder. Moments later, the trapdoor banged shut. She heard the boards overhead groan as the Renault was rolled back into place. And then, silence. Isabel started to panic. It was the locked bedroom again. Madame Doom slamming the door, clicking the lock, telling her to shut up and quit asking for things. She couldn't get out of here, not even in an emergency.
Stop it. Be calm. You know what needs to be done.
She went over to the shelving, pushed her father's shotgun aside, and retrieved the box of medical supplies. A quick inventory revealed scissors, a needle and thread, alcohol, bandages, chloroform, benzedrine tablets, and adhesive tape. She knelt beside the airman and set the lamp down on the floor beside her. Blood soaked the chest of his flight suit, and it took great effort to peel the fabric away. When she did, she saw the giant, gaping hole in his chest and knew there was nothing she could do. She sat beside him, holding his hand until he took one last troubled breath. Then his breathing stopped. His mouth slowly gaped open. She gently eased the dog tags from around his neck. They would need to be hidden. She looked down at them.
Lieutenant Keith Johnson, she said.
Isabel blew out the lamp and sat in the dark with a dead man. The next morning, Vianne dressed in denim overalls and a flannel shirt of Antoine's that she had cut down to fit her. She was so thin these days that the shirt overwhelmed her slim frame. She would have to take it in again. Her latest care package to Antoine sat on the kitchen counter, ready to be mailed. Sophie had had a restless night, so Vianne let her sleep. She went downstairs to make coffee and almost ran into Captain Beck, who was pacing the living room.
Oh, Herr Captain, I am sorry.
He seemed not to hear her. She had never seen him look so agitated. His usually pomaded hair was untended. A lock kept falling in his face, and he cursed repeatedly as he brushed it away. He was wearing his gun, which he never did in the house. He strode past her, his hands fisted at his sides. Anger contorted his handsome face, made him almost unrecognizable.
An aeroplane went down near here last night, he said, facing her at last. An American aeroplane. The one they call a Mustang.
I thought you wanted the aeroplanes to go down. Isn't that why you shoot at them?
We searched all night and didn't find a pilot. Someone is hiding him.
Hiding him? Oh, I doubt that. Most likely he died.
Then there would be a body, madame. We found a parachute, but no body.
But who would be so foolish? Vian said. Don't you execute people for that?
Swiftly.
Vian had never heard him speak in such a way. It made her draw back, and remembered the whip he'd held on the day Rachel and the others were deported.
Forgive my manner, madame, but we have shown you all our best behaviors, and this is what we get from many of you French. Lies and betrayal and sabotage.
Vian's mouth dropped open in shock. He looked at her, saw how she was staring at him, and he tried to smile.
Forgive me again. I don't mean you, of course. The Commandant is blaming me for this failure to find the airmen. I am charged with doing better today.
He went to the front door, opened it.
If I do not...
Through the open door, she saw a glimpse of gray-green in her yard. Soldiers.
Good day, madame.
Vian followed him as far as the front step.
Lock and close all the doors, madame. This pilot may be desperate. You wouldn't want him to break into your home.
Vian nodded numbly. Beck joined his entourage of soldiers and took the lead. Their dogs barked loudly, strained forward, sniffing at the ground along the base of the broken wall. Vian glanced up the hill and saw that the barn door was partially open.
Herr Captain,
she called out. The captain stopped, so did his men. The snarling dogs strained at their leashes. And then she thought of Rachel. This is where Rachel would come if she'd escaped.
No, nothing, Herr Captain,
Vian called out. He nodded brusquely and led his man up the road. Vian slipped into the boots by the door. As soon as the soldiers were out of sight, she hurried up the hill toward the barn. In her haste, she slipped twice in the wet grass and nearly fell. Righting herself at the last minute, she took a deep breath and opened the barn door all the way. She noticed right away that the car had been moved.
"I'm coming, Rachel," she said.
She put the car in neutral and rolled it forward until the cellar door was revealed. Squatting down, she felt for the flat metal handle and lifted the hatch door. When it was high, she let it bang against the car fender. She got a lantern, lit it, and peered down into the dark cellar.
Rach? Go away, Vian, now! Isabelle?
Vian descended the ladder, saying,
Isabelle, what are...
She dropped to the ground and turned, the lantern in her hand swinging light. Her smile faded. Isabel's dress was covered in blood. Her blonde hair was a mess, full of leaves and twigs, and her face was so scratched it looked like she'd gone running in a blackberry patch. But that wasn't the worst of it.
The pilot,
Vian whispered, staring at the man lying on the misshapen mattress. It scared her so much she backed into the shelving. Something clanged to the ground and rolled.
The one they're looking for.
You shouldn't have come down here.
I am the one who shouldn't be here. You fool! Do you know what they'll do to us if they find him here? How could you bring this danger to my house? I'm sorry. Just close the cellar door and put the car back in place. Tomorrow when you wake up, we'll be gone. You're sorry,
Vian said. Anger swept through her. How dare her sister do this thing, put Sophie and her at risk? And now there was Ari here, who still didn't understand that he needed to be Daniel.
You'll get us all killed.
Vian backed away, reached for the ladder. She had to put as much distance as she could between herself and this airman, and her reckless, selfish sister.
Be gone by tomorrow morning, Isabel, and don't come back.
Isabel had the nerve to look wounded.
But don't,
Vian snapped.
I'm done making excuses for you. I was mean to you as a girl. Maman died. Papa is a drunk. Madame Dumas treated you badly. All of it is the truth. And I have longed to be a better sister to you. But that stops here. You are as thoughtless and reckless as always. Only now you will get people killed. I can't let you endanger Sophie. Do not come back. You are not welcome here. If you return, I will turn you in myself.
On that, Fian clambered up the ladder and slammed the cellar door shut behind her. Fian had to keep busy, or she would fall into a full-blown panic. She woke the children and fed them a light breakfast and got started on her chores. After harvesting the last of the autumn's vegetables, she pickled cucumbers and zucchini and canned some pumpkin puree. All the while, she was thinking about Isabel and the airmen in the barn. What should be done? The question haunted her all day, reasserting itself constantly. Every choice was dangerous. Obviously, she should just keep quiet about the airmen in the barn. Silence was always safest. But what if Beck and the Gestapo and the SS and their dogs went into the barn on their own? If Beck found the airman in a barn on the property where he was billeted, the commandant would not be pleased. Beck would be humiliated.
The commandant is blaming me for this failure to find the airman.
Humiliated men could be dangerous. Maybe she should tell Beck. He was a good man. He had tried to save Rachel. He had gotten Ari papers. He mailed Vian's care packages to her husband. Perhaps Beck could be convinced to take the airman and leave Isabel out of it. The airman would be sent to a prisoner of war camp. That was not so bad. She was still grappling with these questions long after supper had ended, and she'd put the children to bed. She didn't even try to go to sleep. How could she sleep with her family at such risk? The thought of that made her anger with Isabel swell again. At 10 o'clock, she heard footsteps out front and a sharp rap-rap on the door. She put down her darning and got to her feet. Smoothing the hair back from her face, she went to the door and opened it. Her hands were trembling so badly she fisted them at her sides.
"Herr Captain," she said, "you are late. Shall I make you something to eat?"
He muttered, "No, thank you," and pushed past her, rougher than he'd ever been before. He went into his room and came back with a bottle of brandy. Pouring himself a huge draft in a chipped cafe glass, he downed the liquid and poured himself another.
"Herr Captain?"
"We didn't find the pilot," he said, downing the second drink, pouring a third.
"Oh,
these Gestapo," he looked at her. "They'll kill me," he said quietly.
"No, surely."
"They do not like to be disappointed."
He drank the third glass of brandy and slammed the glass down on the table, almost breaking it.
"I have looked everywhere," he said. "Every nook and cranny of this godforsaken town. I've looked in cellars and basements and chicken pens, in thickets of thorns and under piles of garbage. And what do I have to show for my efforts? A parachute with blood on it and no pilot."
Surely you haven't looked everywhere," she said to console him. "Shall I get you something to eat? I saved you some supper."
He stopped suddenly. She saw his gaze narrow, heard him say,
"It is not possible, but..."
He grabbed a torchlight and strode to the closet in the kitchen and yanked the door open.
"What are you doing?"
"I am searching your house."
"Surely you don't think..."
She stood there, her heart thumping as he searched from room to room and yanked the coats out of the closet and pulled the divan away from the wall.
"Are you satisfied?"
"Satisfied, madame. We lost 14 pilots this week and God knows how many airplane crew. A Mercedes-Benz factory was blown up 2 days ago and all the workers were killed. My uncle works in that building. Worked, I suppose.
I'm sorry, she said.
Vian drew in a deep breath, thinking it was over, and then she saw that he was going outside. Did she make a sound? She was afraid that she did. She surged after him, wanting to grab his sleeve, but she was too late. He was outside now, following the beam of his torchlight, the kitchen door standing open behind him. She ran after him. He was at the dovecote, yanking the door open.
Herr Captain!
She slowed, tried to calm her breathing as she rubbed her damp palms down her pant legs.
You will not find anything or anyone here, Herr Captain. You must know that.
Are you a liar, madame?
He was not angry. He was afraid.
No. You know I am not. Wolfgang, she said, using his Christian name for the first time. Surely your superiors will not blame you.
This is the problem with you, French, he said. You fail to see the truth when it sits down beside you.
He pushed past her and walked up the hill toward the barn. He would find Isabel and the airmen. And if he did? Prison for all of them, maybe worse. He would never believe that she didn't know about it. She had already shown too much to go back to innocence, and it was too late now to rely on his honor in saving Isabel. Vian had lied to him. He opened the barn door and stood there, his hands on his hips, looking around. He put down his torchlight and lit an oil lamp. Setting it down, he checked every inch of the barn, each stall, and the hayloft.
You see? Vian said. Now come back to the house. Perhaps you'd like another brandy.
He looked down. There were faint tire tracks in the dust.
You said once that Madame de Champlain hid in a cellar.
No.
Vian meant to say something, but when she opened her mouth, nothing came out. He opened the Renault's door, put the car in neutral, and pushed it forward, rolling it far enough to reveal the cellar door.
Captain, please!
He bent down in front of her. His fingers moved along the floor, searching the creases for the edges of the hatch. If he opened that door, it was over. He would shoot Isabel, or take her into custody and send her to prison, and Vian and the children would be arrested. There would be no talking to him, no convincing him. Beck unholstered his gun, cocked it. Vian looked desperately for a weapon, saw a shovel leaned against the wall. He lifted the hatch and yelled something. As the door banged open, he stood up, taking aim. Vian grabbed the shovel and swung it at him with all of her strength. The metal scoop made a sickening thunk as it hit him in the back of the head and sliced deeply into his skull. Blood spurted down the back of his uniform. At the same time, two shots rang out, one from Beck's gun and one from the cellar. Beck staggered sideways and turned. There was a hole the size of an onion in his chest, spurting blood. A flap of hair and scalp hung over one eye.
Madame,
he said, crumpling to his knees. His pistol clattered to the floor. The torchlight rolled across the uneven boards, clattering. Vian threw the shovel aside and knelt down beside Beck, who lay sprawled face first in a pool of his blood. Using all of her weight, she rolled him over. He was pale already, chalkily so. Blood clotted his hair, streaked from his nostrils, bubbled at every breath he took.
I'm sorry,
Vian said. Beck's eyes fluttered open. Vian tried to wipe the blood off his face, but it just made more of a mess. Her hands were red with it now.
I had to stop you,
she said quietly.
Tell my family.
Vian saw the life leave his body, saw his chest stop rising, his heart stop beating. Behind her, she heard her sister climbing up the ladder.
Vian!
Vian couldn't move.
Are you all right?
Isabel asked in a breathless,
wheezing voice. She looked pale and a little shaky.
I killed him. He's dead,
Vian said.
No, you didn't. I shot him in the chest, Isabel said. I hit him in the head with a shovel. A shovel.
Isabel moved toward her.
Vian. Don't,
Vian said sharply.
I don't want to hear some excuse from you. Do you know what you've done? A Nazi, dead in my barn.
Before Isabel could answer, there was a loud whistle, and then a mule-drawn wagon entered the barn. Vian lurched for Beck's weapon, staggered to her feet on the blood-slicked floorboards, and pointed the gun at the strangers.
Vian, don't shoot, Isabel said. They're friends.
Vian looked at the ragged-looking man in the wagon, then at her sister, who was dressed all in black and looked milky pale, with shadows under her eyes.
Of course they are.
She moved sideways, but kept the gun trained on the men crowded onto the front of the rickety wagon. Behind them, in the bed of the wagon, lay a pine coffin. She recognized Henri, the man who ran the hotel in town, with whom Isabel had run off to Paris. The communist with whom Isabel thought she might be in love a little.
Of course, Vian said. Your lover.
Henri jumped down from the wagon and closed the barn door.
What in the fuck happened?
Vian hit him with a shovel and I shot him, Isabel said. There's some sisterly dispute on who killed him, but he's dead. Captain Beck, the soldier who billets here.
Henri exchanged a look with one of the strangers, a scrappy, sharp-faced young man with hair that was too long.
That's a problem, the man said.
Can you get rid of the body?
Isabel asked. She was pressing a hand to her chest as if her heart was beating too fast.
And the airman's, too. He didn't make it.
A big, shaggy man in a patched coat and pants that were too small jumped down from the wagon.
Disposing of the bodies is the easy part.
Who were these people? Isabel nodded.
They'll come looking for Beck. My sister can't stand up to questioning. We'll need to put her and Sophie in hiding.
That did it. They were talking about Vian as if she weren't even here.
Running would only prove my guilt. You can't stay, Isabel said. It isn't safe. By all means, Isabel. Worry about me now, after you've put me and the children at risk and forced me to kill a decent man. Vian, please.
Vian felt something in her harden. It seemed that every time she thought she'd hit rock bottom in this war, something worse came along. Now she was a murderess, and it was Isabel's fault. The last thing she was going to do now was follow her sister's advice and leave Le Jardin.
I will say that Beck left to look for the airman and never returned. What do I, an ordinary French housewife, know of such things? He was here, and then he was gone. C'est la vie.
It's as good an answer as any, Henri said.
This is my fault,
Isabel said, approaching Vian. She saw her sister's regret for this, and her guilt, but Vian didn't care. She was too scared for the children to worry about Isabel's feelings.
Yes, it is, but you made it mine, too. We killed a good man, Isabel.
Isabel swayed a little, unsteady.
They'll come for you,
Vian started to say.
And whose fault is that?
But when she looked at Isabel, the words caught in her throat. She saw blood oozing out from between Isabel's fingers. For a split second, the world slowed down, tilted, became nothing but noise. The men talking behind her, the mule stomping his hoof on the wooden floor, her own labored breathing. Isabel crumpled to the floor, unconscious. Before Vian could even cry out, a hand clamped over her mouth, arms yanked her back. The next thing she knew, she was being dragged away from her sister. She wrestled to be free, but the man holding her was too strong.
She saw Henri drop to his knees beside Isabel and rip open her coat and blouse to reveal a bullet hole just below her collarbone. Henri tore off his shirt and pressed it to the wound.
Vian elbowed her captor hard enough to make him oof. She wrenched free and rushed to Isabel's side, slipping in the blood, almost falling.
"There's a medical kit in the cellar."
The dark-haired man, who suddenly looked as shaky as Vian felt, leapt down the cellar stairs and returned quickly, carrying the supplies. Vian's hands were shaking as she reached for the bottle of alcohol and washed her hands as best she could. She took a deep breath and took over the job of pressing Henri's shirt against the wound, which she felt pulsing beneath her. Twice she had to draw back, wring blood out of the shirt, and start again, but finally the bleeding stopped. Gently, she rolled Isabel into her arms and saw the exit wound. Thank God. She carefully laid Isabel back down.
"This is going to hurt," she whispered. "But you're strong, aren't you, Isabel?"
She doused the wound with alcohol. Isabel shuddered at the contact, but she didn't waken or cry out.
"That's good,"
Vian said. The sound of her own voice calmed her, reminded her that she was a mother, and mothers took care of their families.
"Unconscious is good."
She fished the needle from the medical kit, such as it was, and threaded it. She doused the needle in alcohol, and then leaned down to the wound. Very carefully, she began stitching the gaping flesh together. It didn't take long, and she hadn't done a good job, but it was the best she could do. Once she'd stitched the entrance wound, she felt a little confidence, enough to stitch the exit wound and then to bandage it. At last, she sat back, staring down at her bloody hands and bloodied skirt. Isabel looked so pale and frail, not herself at all. Her hair was filthy and matted, her clothes were wet with her own blood, and the airmen's. And she looked young. So young. Vian felt a shame so deep it made her sick to her stomach. Had she really told her sister, to go away and not come back? How often had Isabel heard that in her life, and from her own family, from people who were supposed to love her?
"I'll take her to the safe house in Brantôme," the black-haired one said.
"Oh, no, you won't," Vian said.
She looked up from her sister, saw that the three men were standing together by the wagon, conspiring. She got to her feet.
"She's not going anywhere with you. You're the reason she's here."
"She's the reason we're here," the dark-haired man said. "I'm taking her, now."
Vian approached the young man. There was a look in his eyes, an intensity, that ordinarily would have frightened her. But she was beyond fear now, beyond caution.
"I know who you are," Vian said. "She described you to me. You're the one from Tours who left her with a note pinned to her chest as if she were a stray dog. Gaston, right?"
"Gaston,"
he said in a voice that was so soft she had to lean toward him to hear.
"And you should know about that. Aren't you the one who couldn't bother to be her sister when she needed one?"
"If you try to take her away from me, I'll kill you."
"You'll kill me,"
he said, smiling. She cocked her head toward Beck.
"I killed him with a shovel, and I liked him."
"Enough," Henri said, stepping between them. "She can't stay here, Vian. Think about it. The Germans are going to come looking for their dead captain. They don't need to find a woman with a gunshot wound and false papers. You understand?"
The big man stepped forward.
"We'll bury the captain and the airman. And we'll make sure the motorcycle disappears. Gaetan, you get her to a safe house in the free zone."
Vian looked from man to man.
"But it's after curfew, and the border is 4 miles away and she's wounded. How will you—"
Halfway through the question, she figured out the answer. The coffin. Vian took a step back. The idea of it was so terrible, she shook her head.
I'll take care of her, Gaetan said.
Vian didn't believe him, not for a second.
I'm going with you, as far as the border. Then I'll walk back when I see that you've gotten her to the free zone.
You can't do that, Gaetan said.
She looked up at him.
You'd be surprised what I can do. Now let's get her out of here.
Chapter 26. May 6th, 1995. The Oregon Coast.
That damned invitation is haunting me. I'd swear it has a heartbeat. For days I have ignored it, but on this bright spring morning, I find myself at the counter, staring down at it. Funny. I don't remember walking over here, and yet here I am. Another woman's hand reaches out. It can't be my hand. Not that veiny, big-knuckled monstrosity that trembles. She picks up the envelope, this other woman. Her hands are shaking even more than usual. Please join us at the AFEES reunion in Paris on May 7th, 1995, the 50th anniversary of the end of the war. For the first time, families and friends of Passeurs will come together in gratitude to honor the extraordinary Nightingale, also known as Juliette Gervais, in the grand ballroom of the Île-de-France Hotel in Paris, 7 o'clock p.m. Beside me, the phone rings. As I reach for it, the invitation slips from my grasp, falls to the counter. Hello? Someone is talking to me in French. Or am I imagining that? Is this a sales call? I ask, confused.
No, no. It is about our invitation.
I almost drop the phone in surprise.
It has been most difficult to track you down, madame. I am calling about the Passeurs' reunion tomorrow night. We are gathering to celebrate the people who made the Nightingale escape route so successful. Did you receive the invitation?
Oui, I say, clutching the receiver.
The first one we sent you was returned, I am sorry to say. Please forgive the tardiness of the invitation. But will you be coming?
It is not me people want to see. It's Juliette, and she hasn't existed for a long time.
You couldn't be more wrong, madame. Seeing you would be meaningful to many people.
I hang up the phone so hard, it is like smashing a bug. But suddenly the idea of going back, going home, is in my mind. It's all I can think about. For years, I kept the memories at bay. I hid them in a dusty attic, far from prying eyes. I told my husband, my children, myself, that there was nothing for me in France. I thought I could come to America and make this new life for myself and forget what I had done to survive. Now I can't forget. Do I make a decision? A conscious, let's think it out and decide what's best kind of decision? No. I make a phone call to my travel agent and book a flight to Paris through New York. Then I pack a bag. It's small, just a rolling carry-on, the sort of suitcase that a businesswoman would take on a 2-day trip. In it, I pack some nylons, a few pairs of slacks and some sweaters, the pearl earrings that my husband bought me on our 40th anniversary, and some other essentials. I have no idea what I will need, and I'm not really thinking straight anyway. Then I wait, impatiently. At the last minute, after I have called a taxi, I call my son and get his message machine. A bit of luck, that. I don't know if I would have the courage to tell him the truth straight up.
Hello, Julian, I say as brightly as I can. I'm going to Paris for the weekend. My flight leaves at 1:10, and I'll call you when I arrive to let you know I'm all right. Give my love to the girls.
I pause, knowing how he will feel when he gets this message, how it will upset him. That's because I have let him think I am weak all these years. He watched me lean on his father and defer to his decision-making. He heard me say, "If that's what you think, dear," a million times. He watched me stand on the sidelines of his life instead of showing him the field of my own. This is my fault. It's no wonder he loves a version of me that is incomplete. I should have told you the truth. When I hang up, I see the taxi pull up out front, and I go.
Chapter 27. October 1942, France. Vianne sat with Gaëtan in the front of the wagon, with the coffin thumping in the wooden bed behind them. The trail through the woods was hard to find in the dark. They were constantly starting and stopping and turning. At some point, it started to rain. The only words they'd exchanged in the last hour and a half were directions.
There,
Vianne said later, as they reached the end of the woods. A light shone up ahead, straining through the trees, turning them into black slashes against a blinding white. The border.
Whoa,
Gaëtan said, pulling back on the reins. Vianne couldn't help thinking about the last time she'd been here.
How will you cross? It's after curfew, she said,
clasping her hands together to still their trembling.
I will be Laurence Olivier, a man overcome by grief, taking his beloved sister home to be buried.
What if they check her breathing?
Then someone at the border will die,
he said quietly. Vianne heard what he didn't say as clearly as the words he chose. She was so surprised that she couldn't think how to respond. He was saying he would die to protect Isabel. He turned to her, gazed at her. Gazed, not looked. Again she saw the predator intensity in those gray eyes. But there was more there, too. He was waiting, patiently, for what she would say. It mattered to him, somehow.
My father came home changed from the Great War, she said quietly,
surprising herself with the admission. This was not something she talked about.
Angry, mean. He started drinking too much. While Maman was alive, he was different.
She shrugged.
After her death, there was no pretense anymore. He sent Isabel and me away to live with a stranger. We were both just girls and heartbroken. The difference between us was that I accepted the rejection. I closed him out of my life and found someone else to love me. But Isabel? She doesn't know how to concede defeat. She hurled herself at the cold wall of our father's disinterest for years, trying desperately to gain his love.
Why are you telling me this?
Isabel seems unbreakable. She has a steel exterior, but it protects a candy floss heart. Don't hurt her, that's what I'm saying. If you don't love her...
I do.
Vianne studied him.
Does she know?
I hope not.
Vianne would not have understood that answer a year ago. She wouldn't have understood how dark a side love could have, how hiding it was the kindest thing you could do sometimes.
I don't know why it's so easy for me to forget how much I love her. We start fighting and...
Sisters,
Vianne sighed.
I suppose, although I haven't been much of one to her.
You'll get another chance.
Do you believe that?
His silence was answer enough. At last he said,
Take care of yourself, Vianne. She'll need a place to come home to when all of this is over.
If it's ever over.
Oui.
Vianne got down from the wagon. Her boots sunk deep into wet, muddy grass. I'm not sure she thinks of me as a safe place to come home to, she said.
You'll need to be brave, Gaëtan said. When the Nazis come looking for their man, you know our real names. That's dangerous for all of us, you included.
I'll be brave, she said. You just tell my sister that she needs to start being afraid. For the first time, Gaëtan smiled, and Vianne understood how this scrawny, sharp-featured man in his beggar's clothes had swept Isabel off her feet. He had the kind of smile that inhabited every part of his face, his eyes, his cheeks. There was even a dimple. I wear my heart on my sleeve, that smile said, and no woman could be unmoved by such transparency.
Oui, he said, because it is so easy to tell your sister anything.
Fire. It's all around her, leaping, dancing, a bonfire. She can see it in the quivering strands of red that come and go. A flame licks her face, burns deep. It's everywhere, and then it's gone. The world is icy, white, sheer and cracked. She shivers with the cold, watches her fingers turn blue and crackle and break apart. They fall away like chalk, dusting her frozen feet.
Isabel.
Bird song. A nightingale. She hears it singing a sad song. Nightingales mean loss, don't they? Love that leaves or doesn't last or never existed in the first place. There's a poem about that, she thinks. An ode. No, not a bird. A man. The king of the fire, maybe. A prince in hiding in the frozen woods. A wolf. She looks for footprints in the snow.
Isabel.
Wake up. She heard his voice in her imagination. Gaëtan. He wasn't really here. She was alone. She was always alone. And this was too strange to be anything but a dream. She was hot and cold and achy and worn out. She remembered something. A loud noise. Vianne's voice.
Don't come back. I'm here.
She felt him sit beside her. The mattress shifted to accommodate his imaginary weight. Something cool and damp pressed to her forehead, and it felt so good that she was momentarily distracted. And then she felt his lips graze hers and linger there. He said something she couldn't quite hear, and then he drew back. She felt the end of the kiss as deeply as she'd felt the start of it. It felt so real. She wanted to say, "Don't leave me." But she couldn't do it. Not again. She was so tired of begging people to love her. Besides, he wasn't really here. So what would be the point of saying anything? She closed her eyes and rolled away from the man who wasn't there. Vianne sat on Beck's bed. Ridiculous that she thought of it that way, but there it was. She sat in this room that had become his, hoping that it wouldn't always be his in her mind. In her hand was the small portrait of his family.
You would love Hilda. Here, she sent you this strudel, madame, for putting up with a lout such as myself.
Vianne swallowed hard. She didn't cry for him again. She refused to, but God, she wanted to cry for herself, for what she had done, for who she had become. She wanted to cry for the man she'd killed and the sister who might not live. It had been an easy choice, killing Beck to save Isabel. So why had Vianne been so quick to turn on Isabel before?
You're not welcome here.
How could she have said that to her own sister? What if those were among the last words ever spoken between them?
As she sat staring at the portrait, "Tell my family." She waited for a knock at the door. It had been 48 hours since Beck's murder. The Nazis should be here any minute. It wasn't a question of if, but when. They would bang on her door and push their way inside. She had spent hours trying to figure out what to do. Should she go to the commandant's office and report Beck missing? No, foolish. What French person would report such a thing? Or should she wait until they came to her? Never a good thing. Or should she try to run? That only made her remember Sarah and the moonlit night that would forever make her think of bloody streaks on a child's face and brought her right back to the beginning again.
"Maman,"
Sophie said, standing in the open doorway with the toddler on her hip.
"You need to eat something,"
Sophie said. She was taller, almost Vian's height. When had that happened? And she was thin. Vian remembered when her daughter had had apple-like cheeks and eyes that sparkled with mischief. Now she was like all of them, stretched thin as jerky and aged beyond her years.
"They're going to come to the door soon," Vian said.
She'd said it so often in the past 2 days that her words surprised no one.
"You remember what to do?"
Sophie nodded solemnly. She knew how important this was, even if she didn't know what had become of the captain. Interestingly, she hadn't asked. Vian said,
"If they take me away..."
"They won't," Sophie said.
"And if they do?"
Vian said.
"We wait for you to return for 3 days, and then we go to Mother Marie-Thérèse at the convent."
Someone pounded on the door. Vian lurched to her feet so fast she stumbled sideways and hit her hip into the corner of the table, dropping the portrait. The glass on it cracked.
"Upstairs, Sophie, now!"
Sophie's eyes bulged, but she knew better than to speak. She tightened her hold on the toddler and ran upstairs. When Vian heard the bedroom door slam shut, she smoothed her worn skirt. She had dressed carefully in a gray wool cardigan and an often mended black skirt, a respectable look. Her hair had been curled and carefully styled into waves that softened her thin face. The pounding returned. She allowed herself one indrawn, calming breath as she crossed the room. Her breathing was almost steady as she opened the door. Two German Schutzstaffel SS soldiers stood there, wearing sidearms. The shorter of the two pushed past Vian, shoving her out of his way as he entered the house. He strode from room to room, pushing things aside, sending what few knick-knacks remained crashing to the floor. At Beck's room, he stopped and turned back.
"This is Hauptmann Beck's room?"
Vian nodded. The taller soldier came at Vian fast, leaning forward as if there were a harsh wind at his back. He looked down at her from on high, his forehead obscured by a shiny military cap.
"Where is he?"
"How would I know?"
"Who is upstairs?"
the soldier demanded.
"I hear something."
It was the first time she'd ever been asked about Ari.
"My children..."
The lie caught in her voice, came out too soft. She cleared her throat and tried again.
"You may go up there, of course, but please don't waken the baby. He's sick with the flu, or perhaps tuberculosis."
This last, she added, because she knew how frightened the Nazis were of getting sick. She reached down for her handbag, clamped it to her chest as if it offered some protection. He nodded at the other German, who strode confidently up the stairs. She heard him moving around overhead. The ceiling creaked. Moments later, he came back downstairs and said something in German.
"Come with us," the taller one said. "I'm sure you have nothing to hide."
He grabbed Vian's arm and dragged her out to the black Citroën parked by the gate. He shoved her into the back seat and slammed the door shut. Vian had about 5 minutes to consider her situation before they stopped again, and she was being yanked up the stone steps of the town hall. There were people all around the square, soldiers and locals. The villagers dispersed quickly when the Citroën pulled up.
It's Vian Moyak,
she heard someone say, a woman. The Nazi's hold on her upper arm was bruising, but she made no sound as he pulled her into the town hall and down a set of narrow steps. There, he shoved her through an open door and slammed it shut. It took her eyes a moment to adjust to the gloom. She was in a small, windowless room with stone walls and a wood floor. A desk sat in the middle of the room, decorated with a plain black lamp that delivered a cone of light onto the scratched wood. Behind the desk, and in front of it, were straight-backed wooden chairs. She heard the door open behind her and then close. Footsteps followed. She knew someone had come up behind her. She could smell his breath, sausage and cigarettes, and the musky scent of his sweat.
Madam,
he said, so close to her ear that she flinched. Hands clamped around her waist, squeezing tightly.
Do you have any weapons?
He said, his terrible French drawing sibilance from the words. He felt up her sides, slid his spidery fingers across her breasts, giving the smallest of squeezes, and then felt down her legs.
No weapons. Good.
He walked past her and took his seat at the desk. Blue eyes peered out from beneath his shiny black military hat.
Sit.
She did as she was told, folding her hands into her lap.
I am Sturmbannführer von Richter. You are Madame Vian Moyag.
She nodded.
You know why you are here,
he said, taking a cigarette from his pocket, lighting it with a match that glowed in the shadows.
No,
she said, her voice unsteady, her hands shaking just a little.
Hauptmann Beck is missing.
Missing? Are you certain?
When is the last time you saw him, madam?
She frowned.
I hardly keep track of his movements, but if pressed, I would say 2 nights ago. He was quite agitated.
Agitated?
It was the downed airman. He was most unhappy that he had not been found. Herr Captain believed someone was hiding him.
Someone?
Vian forced herself not to look away, nor did she tap her foot nervously on the floor or scratch the itch that was making its uncomfortable way across her neck.
He searched all day for the airman. When he came home, he was agitated is the only word I know to use. He drank an entire bottle of brandy and broke a few things in my house in his rage. And then
she paused, letting her frown deepen.
And then?
I'm sure it means nothing at all.
He slammed his palm down on the table so hard the light shuddered.
What?
Herr Captain suddenly said, I know where he's hiding, and grabbed his sidearm and left my home, slamming the door shut behind him. I saw him jump on his motorcycle and take off down the road at an unsafe speed, and then nothing. He never returned. I assumed he was busy at the Kommandantur. As I said, his comings and goings are not my concern.
The man drew a long drag on his cigarette. The tip glowed red and then slowly faded to black. Ash rained down on the desk. He studied her from behind a veil of smoke.
A man would not want to leave a woman as beautiful as yourself.
Vian didn't move.
Well,
he said at last, dropping his cigarette butt to the floor. He stood abruptly and stomped on the still-lit cigarette, grinding on it with his boot heel.
I suspect the young Hauptmann was not as skilled with a gun as he should have been. The Wehrmacht,
he said, shaking his head.
Often they are a disappointment. Disciplined, but not eager.
He came out from behind the desk and walked toward Vian. As he neared, she stood. Politeness demanded it.
The Hopman's misfortune is my fortune.
Oh? His gaze moved down her throat to the pale skin above her breasts.
I need a new place to billet. The Hotel Bellevue is unsatisfactory. I believe your house will do nicely.
When Vian stepped out of the town hall, she felt like a woman who'd just washed ashore. She was unsteady on her feet and trembling slightly. Her palms were damp, her forehead itchy. Everywhere she looked in the square were soldiers. These days, the black SS uniforms were predominant. She heard someone yell, "Halt!"
Saw a pair of women in ratty coats with yellow stars on their chests being shoved to their knees by a soldier with a gun.
The soldier grabbed one of the two and dragged her to her feet while the older one screamed. It was Madame Fournier, the butcher's wife.
Her son Gilles yelled,
"You can't take my maman,"
and started to surge at the two French policemen who were nearby. A gendarme grabbed the boy, yanked hard enough to make him stop.
"Don't be a fool."
Vian didn't think. She saw her former student in trouble, and she went to him. He was just a boy, for God's sake, Sophie's age. Vian had been his teacher since before he could read.
"What are you doing?"
she demanded to know, realizing a second too late that she should have tempered her voice. The policeman turned to look at her. Paul. He was even fatter than the last time she'd seen him. His face had puffed out enough to make his eyes as small and slitted as sewing needles.
"Stay out of this, madame," Paul said.
"Madame Mauriac,"
Gilles cried.
"They're taking my maman to the train. I want to go with her."
Vian looked at Gilles' mother,
Madame Fournier, the butcher's wife, and saw defeat in her eyes.
"Come with me, Gilles,"
Vian said without really thinking.
"Merci,"
Madame Fournier whispered.
Paul yanked Gilles close again.
"Enough! The boy is making a scene. He is coming with us."
"No,"
Vian said.
"Paul, please, we are all French."
She hoped the use of his name would remind him that before all of this, they'd been a community. She'd taught his daughters.
"The boy is a French citizen. He was born here."
"We don't care where he was born, madame. He's on my list. He goes."
His eyes narrowed.
"Do you want to lodge a complaint?"
Madame Fournier was crying now, clutching her son's hand.
The other policeman blew his whistle and prodded Gilles forward with the barrel of his gun. Gilles and his mother stumbled into the crowd of others being herded toward the train station.
"We don't care where he was born, madame."
Beck had been right. Being French would no longer protect Ari. She clamped her handbag tightly beneath her armpit and headed for home. As usual, the road had turned to mud and ruined her shoes by the time she reached the gate at Le Jardin. Both of the children were waiting in the living room. Relief loosened her shoulders. She smiled tiredly as she set down her handbag.
"You're all right?"
Sophie said. Ari immediately moved toward her, grinning, opening his arms for a hug, saying,
"Maman!"
with a grin to prove that he understood the rules of their new game. She pulled the three-year-old into her arms and held him tightly. To Sophie, she said,
"I was questioned and released. That is the good news."
"And the bad news?"
Vian looked at her daughter, defeated. Sophie was growing up in a world where boys in her class were put in train carriages like cattle, at the point of a gun, and perhaps never seen again.
"Another German is going to billet here. Will he be like Herr Captain Beck?"
Vian thought of the feral gleam in von Richter's ice-blue eyes and the way he searched her.
"No,"
she said softly.
"I don't expect he will be. You are not to speak to him unless you must. Don't look at him. Just stay as invisible as you can. And Sophie, they're deporting French-born Jews now. Children, too. Putting them on trains and sending them away to work camps."
Vian tightened her hold on Rachel's son.
He is Daniel now, your brother. Always, even when we are alone. The story is that we adopted him from a relative in Nice. We can never make a mistake or they'll take him, and us, away. You understand? I don't want anyone to ever even look at his papers.
I'm scared, Maman,
she said quietly. As am I, Sophie, was all Vianne could say. They were in this together now, taking this terrible risk. Before she could say more, there was a knock on the door, and Sternbahnfuhrer von Richter walked into her home, standing as straight as a bayonet blade, his face impassive beneath the glossy black military hat. Silver iron crosses hung from various places on his black uniform, his stand-up collar, his chest. A swastika pin decorated his left breast pocket.
Madame Mauriac, he said. I see you walked home in the rain.
Mais oui, she answered, smoothing the damp, frizzy hair from her face.
You should have asked my men for a ride. A beautiful woman such as yourself should not slog through the mud like a heifer to the trough.
Oui, merci. I will be so bold as to ask them next time. He strode forward without removing his hat. He looked around, studying everything. She was sure that he noticed the marks on the walls where paintings had once hung, and the empty mantle, and the discoloration in the floor where rugs had lain for decades. All gone now.
Yes. This will do.
He looked at the children.
And who have we here?
He asked in terrible French. My son, Vianne said, standing beside him, moving in close enough to touch them both. She didn't say Daniel in case Ari corrected her. And my daughter, Sophie.
I do not remember Oppenbeck mentioning two children.
And why would he, Herr Sternbahnfuhrer? It's hardly noteworthy.
Well,
he said, nodding crisply to Sophie.
You girl, go get my bags.
To Vianne, he said.
Show me the rooms. I shall choose the one I want.